Welcome to the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, where it's all about slashing your debt, slashing your taxes, and creating a liberated lifestyle. And now, your host, who has a vast collection of vintage DC and Marvel comic books, and ironically lives in Minnesota, where his favorite NBA team, the LA Lakers, originated, Dave Denniston.
Hello, my friends. Welcome back to another episode of the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, a podcast dedicated to helping doctors like you slash your debt, slash your taxes, and live a liberated lifestyle. Welcome back to season five. Today, we're doing yet another physician fireside chat, talking about another doctor's stories and travails and things that he has been through, learning about his life and lessons to be learned. Today on the podcast, we have a physician that is an internal medicine physician scientist and really turned entrepreneur. He did his MBBS back in India, came here to the US, lives in Kansas now as a intensivist, hospitalist, and internal medicine physician. And he has really kind of turned on his entrepreneur genes lately, where he's gotten into real estate syndication and being an angel investor. Please help me welcome Dr. Harsha Mohl. Welcome, Harsha.
Hey, David, how are you?
I'm doing great.
Thank you for the great introduction.
Oh, you're so welcome. I think it's so fun getting to connect with unique people like yourself that come from a different background than many of us have. And you're doing some really interesting stuff with your investment life. So I definitely want to dive more into that. But before we do, I'd love to know a little bit about your past. I mentioned that you're from India. So tell us a bit about that and where you grew up.
First of all, happy to be here. So I grew up in the southern part of India, a city called Hyderabad, one of the metro cities in the country. Did my medical school training over there. And then it's an interesting story. I wanted to stay back there and do my master's and settle down there. But one of my friends convinced me to kind of just come here for a month to kind of rotate in a hospital in Miami to kind of intern under a doctor and check out the American system. And then the original plan was to just come over here for a month, but then I kind of bought into the whole idea of American healthcare system and saw how things were run inside a hospital. And I ended up pursuing further in that direction. And I got trained in Chicago area. And then now I practice primarily in the Midwest as an internist and internal medicine doctor.
So take me back to India and growing up, southern India. So is that kind of tropical or what's the weather like down there?
If I had to compare it to an American state, it would probably be Texas weather.
Texas weather?
More or less, correct. I mean, the southernmost states are tropical like Miami, but I'm like a little bit southern central, which feels like Texas.
I was talking to another gentleman from India the other day, and he had said that the southern people are wimpy on the spice. what's your reaction to that? Northern India is more spicy.
I think the southernmost, the tropical states are a little bit, they go easy on the spice, but the state I come from is known for its spice. So there is a specific region called Rayalaseema where growing up, my dad was his parents were farmers, and the basic meal they had every day was they used to just cook rice and put freshly cut onions and the chili powder and some salt in it, and that was their meal. Hmm. So the part of the country that I come from is very known for its spicy food again, but it varies a lot based on which part of southern India you're from. If you talk about a state called Kerala, their food is very flavorful, but not as hot spicy.
Interesting. Yeah. Each is like its own country.
And I would rather be in another country as opposed to another state in India, because I can communicate in English language in other countries. But if you go to another state in India, it's a completely different lifestyle, language, food, culture, everything.
Interesting. And so tell me about growing up there. Did you have a physician in the family, or what led you to becoming a physician?
That fits the bill. It happens in most Indian families. Growing up, you have your aunt, uncle as a doctor. You get inspired looking at their work style or lifestyle. Same thing happened in my case. My dad's elder brother was a physician. He owned his own hospital and used to visit almost like on a bi-weekly basis just to say hi and family gatherings. And although my parents like provided me a lot of support and encouragement, and primarily the reason why I am here is because of them. I think a bit of influence from my uncle, who was a general practitioner, also played quite a big role in kind of understanding what physician's life is and what to expect when you grow up.
And coming and growing up, you know, what was money like? You know, I think of India as being a place where there are definitely very, very poor people. But then there's also people that have a good deal of money. And I'm sure there's a middle class in there too. Tell me more about that experience growing up and thoughts on money and what you were taught about money.
Honestly, there is no, it depends on the family that you grow up in. I always like to think about it like Robert Kiyosaki's way of saying, I mean, there is different people giving you different influences. So growing up, like you correctly said, there is wide disparity in India. There is a huge chunk of population below the poverty line, unable to get the basic amenities in life, food, water, shelter. But on the other hand, there is this billionaire section who made like tons of money on real estate because the way the country has evolved over the last 20 years is majority of the software market in America, they started setting up their outsourcing hubs in my city where I live in. So that gave rise to these mega structures and started employment. Growing up in my end, like I grew up in with very modest beginnings. My dad, although he is a mechanical civil engineer by training, he was not comfortable dealing with the corruption in the system or the kickbacks in the system, so he chose to go back and do large scale farming. So for us, money was all about getting by through the month, meaning just get our food, water, whatnot. So I particularly saw the value in businesses or long-term investment. All the money that we made as a family was not from what he made at the end of the month, but because of the land that we bought or from the real estate appreciation that we noticed, that's our family wealth today. So that's always been like one of the core thought processes that I've had, saying you can never depend on your like a monthly W-2 check to kind of guarantee your future. You need to have streams of revenue, and you also need to have multiple asset classes that you spread your investments in. So even though, God forbid, something bad happens in one angle, there is another one left to protect you and your family. So those were like kind of a core overall bird's eye view ideologies that I kind of noticed growing up when I looked at my uncle, how he did, how my family was doing, how did we get from me being a three-year-old kid to right now a physician in India. So that's kind of an overview. I hope that answers your question.
No, I think that's great. And so walk me through, so your uncle played a huge influence and you got to go to his hospital and your father taught you about streams of income. The MBBS, from what I understand of it, is that it's like an undergrad and graduate program combined, where you actually walk out with your MBBS, which is like the equivalent of an MD from what I understand in India. Was that your experience or was that?
I am surprised by how much you know about MBBS. I've probably not met another American who knows so much about what the term, like what MBBS includes. Most of the people that I meet, they kind of tend to think MBBS is an undergrad, but you are right. It's a combination of undergrad, right, packaged into a 5.5-year course. That will basically, at the end of MBBS, you will be getting a license to practice medicine. Now, that being said, it's not a specialty training. In America, the way it works is after your medical school, you cannot practice medicine. You still have to go through this process called residency training, which is about 3 to 4 years time frame. Mm-hmm. That gives you the MD degree. Same thing in India. After MBBS, you can practice as a general practitioner in like wherever you choose to, but then you don't have a specialty. But for that specialty, country, you still have to go through 3 to 4 more years of training and then you get there. But again, I split paths with India once I was done with MBBS. Any foreign medical graduate has to go through the same American system. They call it USMLE step 1, 2, 3, and then you do the test based on the scores. You apply for a bunch of programs in America and then see what happens.
So tell us about that process. Was that, because I think there's only a certain number of people admitted a year, right, to the U.S.?
It is. There is a massive disparity or like a difference in the ratios of like when, what happens when an American citizen applies for a residency training and Indian or like a foreign medical graduate applies for it. More or less, the way that I think the easiest way to put it is we all go through the same funnel. There is very limited residency programs that offer visas. That's where, like, even though we go through the same funnel or have the same credentials, majority of the foreign grads are filtered out because, or they cannot be eligible in many programs because those programs do not offer a visa. You either have to be a citizen or a permanent resident to go through. But in regards to the educational part of it, it is a very prolonged process, meaning people in America going to med school here, they get trained specifically for those USMLE tests while they're in medical school, meaning you're year one of medical school. At the end of year one or year two, you take your step one USMLE. By the end of your medical school year four here, and then you take your step two, step three, whatnot. But in India, it's double the work for foreign grads because during the MBBS part of it, we have our own set of completely 100% different category of tests that we have to take to clear the MBBS exam and get a doctorate degree there. Now, after that is done, that's when, like, so we go through all those 5.5 year period without understanding a single thing about USMLE step one, step two. After that, that's when we start from the scratch saying, okay, now we want to kind of try out American healthcare system. For that, we need to prepare, start preparing for USMLE. And that's when we started, and usually a 1.5 to 2 year process to kind of go over like the 4 different tests and then apply and then get in. It is a very time taking process. And the tricky part with USMLE is if you score well, you're good. If you fail the test, it's a bad thing, but you're still okay because if you fail, you can reattempt the test right away. But if you end up being somewhere in the middle, like mediocre average score, you cannot retake the test. The programs wouldn't give you an interview or they would not select you because your scores are not great. Now, the most sad part is that you cannot give the test for 7 more years. So you're stuck with that mediocre score, which will not help you for 7 more years.
So what happened in your case? Did you fail the test or did you get up and up the part each time?
Luckily, fortunately, I did pretty good in all the 3-4 different tests that we took. And I was fortunate enough to kind of get into a really reputable institution in the Midwest.
Nice. So you get into residency at University of Illinois.
Yeah.
And is that in Chicago? Where is that?
The one I got trained in is in Peoria, Illinois, which is 2.5 hours south of Chicago. But University of Illinois is, not many people know this, it's the largest medical school in the country. It has 5 different campuses, I think 4 or 5, from Chicago, Springfield, Peoria, I think Urbana-Champaign and Rockford. I think there's 4 or 5 campuses. So, yeah.
So you're there, and Peoria is not a huge city by any means. You know, was it a bit of a culture shock? You know, what was it like being a resident here in the U.S.?
Being a resident, to answer your question about the cultural shock, it takes about a couple of months to get used to it, meaning just the basics of how do you speak with another person, meaning how do you say hi or how do you say hello, meaning all right, good night. Because in back home in India, when you meet a person, you greet them by just smiling or like a different form of greeting. Here you say hi, have a good day, hope you're having a great day. Or when you're saying bye, you say like, so there's several layers of things that you kind of quickly have to get acclimatized to kind of to gel well with the local community. And I think like one of the blessings that physical medical community has is we get to interact with so many Native American, like when I say Native, like American born citizens in the hospital setting, that it's very easy for us to catch those things because we are forced to kind of speak with them because we are treating them.
Yes.
And I think it's very, very important for us to learn the local way because that's the best way to connect with patients in a different level. If patient sees you as like some sort of an alien person treating you, there's always that bridge that will not be met, meaning you have to make those extra steps to kind of get to the community level to understand them.
And so in this time, normally, as I'm sure you've gotten to know some of your colleagues that have gone to American medical schools, they often have $200,000 or $300,000 or more of student debt. What was that like for you? Did you come to America with any debt at all? Or what was that journey like financially trying to make it from India to here?
That's a really good question. To answer that question, I should go back to how Indian medical school system works. It's probably many more times competitive compared to American MCAT system. For example, 80,000 people take the MCAT test in the state that I grew up in. Out of the 80,000, overall, let's say there is 2,000 spots. That's it. There's only 2,000 spots, medical school spots. So that's the ratios that we're talking about. And the first 800 get to go to the medical school for free. When you get the MCAT test, whoever ranks in the first 600 to 800 get to go for free. Meaning there is some nominal fee, but that's pretty much nothing because when you're doing your final year of internship, like in the MBBS, they pay you back that money because you're offering your services to treat the patients. But if you fall under the second 1,000 in among the MCAT, meaning if you rank 800 through 2,000, you have to pay quite a bit of money to go there, but that's still not in the hundreds of thousands of dollars range. And then there is a third category called payment category where people pay, if I had to make a guess, the going rate right now, I have to do a quick math, is probably around $150,000 American dollars will get you a medical school spot in India. Even if you just pass the test, you don't have to compete in a big level. Now, this is outside those 2,000 seats that we talked about. Those 2,000 spots are for the people who go through MCAT, and that's a competitive ranking-based system. But then there's probably another maybe, I don't know, 500 spots that are purely for payment category, which is $150,000. You see a lot of Indian-born, American-born Indians that send their kids to India to through this path. They look at the whatever like the loans here, massive fee.
Yes,
and they're like, and then to them it's like a math number. Well, they get $300,000, $400,000 loans here, but then the medical school system takes about 8 years, 4 years of pre-grad. And,
yeah.
4 years of grad. Well, if I send them to India, it's only 150, and then it's only it's only 5.5 years.
Yep.
So that's kind of the system. So personally, in my case, I was again fortunate enough that I grew up in an environment which made me study well, and I was in the first like 300 of the test scorers, and I got in for free. When I moved here, I did not have any debt, so all the money that I made in my training and now is. It goes towards several investments and not towards my debt clearance.
So what was that like, you know, when I would think, and I'm not sure because I haven't been to India, but for most of us here, we think $50,000 to $60,000 a year as a resident isn't very much money, but I have to imagine as you looked at that number, it's like, oh my gosh, this is a ton of money. Was that not the reaction? You know, what was that like?
Oh, absolutely it is. As I said, I come from very humble beginnings. To me, every dollar or every rupee, Indian currency, is valuable. So first things first, we had some family loans, which I cleared them with just my training money. And I bought myself a car. I made some, like, I helped my parents improve their home in India just with residency money, all again. So that was a very gratifying experience. That's the effect that I got when I got my first residency paycheck was, oh, now it all makes sense. All those years of hard work and, like, studying, it's finally shaping up to being something good. I see the light at the end of the tunnel sort of a reaction.
Interesting. Well, I know that supporting the family and giving back to the family is so important in Indian culture. I have seen that you'll have mother-in-laws and father-in-laws living with a family is not uncommon at all.
Absolutely. You are spot on. And the way I think, like, Indian families, and I see this in South America. This is something that I learned in the last few years with South American families. Let's say my kid goes, like, if I had to pay the money to go to med school in India, there is nothing, there is no system of student loan. Parents pay for it. If they cannot pay for it, they don't do it. Meaning the kid doesn't go to school. There is no getting a medical loan and then going to med school. That system is non-existent in India. So that's the reason even people who go to these paid medical schools in India, they don't have a loan because they're obviously rich enough to pay for it. Their parents pay for it. And it goes the other way around when the parents grow old. The kids, it is an unsaid rule that kids take care of the parents. There is no nursing homes, there is no assisted livings, there is no senior livings, nothing. They took care of us for whatever we needed until we were 30, 35, until I became independent, and I take care of them when they need something. So it's a different system. I'm not trying to criticize any particular country system.
Sure.
Every country has its own pros, cons, but that's how things work in India. And what I've learned recently is that's how things work in majority of the South American countries.
Interesting. Yeah, I could totally see that. I mean, that's the way it used to be, right? Before wealth was something that happened in the U.S. even. You know, so yep, I think if you turn the clock back to 100 years ago or a little longer, then I think that was very common. Parents would be living with their kids because they can't afford it otherwise. So I think just because of what we've been blessed with here in the U.S., you can have all these different things. But anyhow, so I'm curious to know, you know, as you look at financial freedom and what that means to you, how are you factoring in, and how do you think about financial freedom coming from India? Like, do you have to factor in, okay, I need to have $1,000 a month for my parents, and I'm gonna try and take care of myself? Or are you looking at, gosh, I want my kids to support me eventually? You know, how are you looking at that concept of financial freedom?
It's a very this is a question I ask myself, believe me, every day. I try to come up with numbers. Okay, how much do I need to retire? Like, I don't have a numerical answer for it, but I do have a qualitative answer, meaning to me, although the numbers are important, to me, like, the quality of life, to me, what I want is I want myself to be in a situation where I am able to take care of my parents or my fiance's parents and my kids while I keep my W-2 job. The main reason I practice medicine is because I like doing what I do. Even though I talk so much about being financially independent, financially free, I do not or cannot think of a day where I stop practicing medicine. I would still continue to do what I do, but for the passion of the field. But that being said, I don't believe or buy into the idea that a person should be getting only one stream of income. God forbid if there is some sort of a trauma or something that I, like, where I cannot perform my duties as a doctor, I still want to have a viable source of revenues. That is what financial freedom means to me. And that revenue stream should be not streams, plural. And I want those to be strong enough to be able to support my family, my parents' family, and maybe a few friends if they're in need of help. So I want to set up like systems in place in several avenues, several verticals, which are able to accomplish this for me. And again, that it goes a little bit deeper. And I also like to talk a little bit about asset protection, but then again, that becomes kind of a too much different topic. But
Well, I think this is a great segue to talk about the real estate journey. So you're now in 2016. So we'll go past the residency phase. You're able to help the family out some, now you're on your own working as a hospitalist in Kansas. So you found a gig in Kansas, and walk us through, you know, it sounds like streams of income has been something that has been important throughout your whole life as you looked at your family and your uncle and your dad with farming. At what point did you start getting into real estate?
We were involved in real estate growing up, like in India. In India, majority of the real estate that's booming or has a good prospect is land. There's so little land, so many people, mm-hmm. so that equation never stops growing. It is very surprising for when I talk those the numbers that happen in India, when I share them with my American friends, like they just open their mouth because that's how big they are. Meaning if you know the local lay of the land, and then if you buy a property, just buy a piece of land, and I bet in probably 2 to 3 years that'll end up doubling because that's how the growth is happening back there. And there's people, majority of them, they buy a land with a bank loan. And they keep paying interest every month. That's how sure people are that it's going to appreciate in value, that it's going to cover their bank loan and the interest.
And banks are willing to lend on land.
Absolutely. That should say something about the market. In fact, banks come and like they get the broker and they sometimes solicit saying, hey, you are a doctor here, you own a hospital, you should have the funds, and that's a great property, and this is the broker. We'll provide you the financing. So it's a wild game. So I was aware of the markets back home in India, but we did a little bit of it because lack of funds again. Growing up, we were not an affluent family, but we were a very comfortable family, but not affluent enough to kind of go get into the real estate game on a professional basis. But I had those concepts in mind. So when I moved here, during my training, there was not a lot of time to kind of think about it because it was 100% focused on medical training. And by the end of the day, I had no time or energy to kind of spare on other things. But after training, once I started working as an internal medicine physician, that's when like the hospitalist job that most of the people do here is 7 days on, 7 days off. So you have a lot of time off to reflect upon what you want to do with your life. So the first 6 months, I just sat down and just looked at things, meaning... And I mean, I do that even now, but back then, that's all I did. I read about stuff. I spoke to people who were doing good things. Primarily real estate was, we already do a lot of retirement investing through the empire that we have. So in my mind, I was like, well, if I have a 403 and a 457, there's already approximately 40 grand going into my retirement savings, and most of it is like in the stocks, bonds sort of situation. So at least for the next few years, because I'm already familiar with looking at the numbers for real estate, why don't I get to understand the American real estate market just like I understand the Indian market? So that's when I started looking into several aspects of it, speaking to people about what they do, what's a single family business like, what's multifamily business like, what's syndication, what's commercial, so on and so forth. So that's kind of how the whole process evolved, when there was a lot of contemplation and learning and just sitting back and absorbing all the material. And that happened for about 6 months to 1 year time frame after my training.
Interesting. So you're just absorbing, you're learning. Any particular mentors or books or things that really helped you that you think would be great to pass on to other people?
I did read a couple of books from the Bigger Pockets, Brandon Turner. They go over like basic details of for a new amateur guy who wants to learn about the business model. I got my basics from him, but then I think like when for me the most important driving force was again my family influence and content philosophy, content put out by Robert Kiyosaki, meaning yes, you can make a W-2 income, but that's just not going to cut the deal, meaning we are capable of doing much more and there's better ways of doing things and you want to do it. So I think like when I look back, more than anything, meaning if you look at things that you do or I do, it's the reason that you're successful the way you are or I'm successful the way I am. If I had to answer, like if I had to answer for myself, I think it's the mindset and the determination. I mean, without the mindset, even though you have all the moving blocks, it's difficult to position them in a way that they succeed. So that's been like the main influence of like Brandon Turner's book, Robert Kiyosaki's philosophy background. And there is some tax books that I read from Amanda Hand. She's a CPA based out of California, who is again, I think in, she works in collaboration with Bigger Pockets. So those kind of like are the main beginning starter pack that I used. But then on a bird's eye view, majority of what I learned was not from the books. I mean, that gave me an idea of what questions to ask, meaning when I go into the market, just so I know what I'm talking about. But I would say 90% of what I learned was from direct doing it, meaning you when I first like got involved in like being a partner in a company that bought a bread and breakfast hotel. Like, how do those interactions happen? What are the numbers that we're looking at? What teams are involved in putting through a deal? Once you get a deal done, what teams are involved in maintaining or managing it? Okay, once the profits start to come back, what teams are involved in tax strategizing or reinvesting that money? So that one, I think like, I learned 90% of whatever I know about the market by doing things and not by absorbing, because there's only so much you can learn by kind of just sitting back and like learning through passively. I strongly believe in actively doing something if I want to like get the ins and outs of it.
So I'm sure there's someone listening right now that has this question. They're listening to this podcast and they're saying, you know, I think that's all great. And I agree with you. But how do I do that? You know, how do I decide where I should start and make that first leap? How would you evaluate that? What would be your advice to them?
I think whoever like is considering an investment option in real estate, when they are like reading about it, looking into it, it's very clearly laid out in any kind of blog post or Google article or book that they read, saying what are the pros and cons of each. When they're reading it, they'll have a feel for it. That would kind of should help them determine which initial direction they should go. Should they go in a single family, multifamily, commercial? And then I think the best way to like do it is think of a small amount of money that you think you can invest, which would not hurt you if you lose it. Yes. Let's say in my case, in my mind, I was like, well, I have $10,000. That was like a couple months into training. I thought that is my, I consider this as R&D money, research and development money. I want to make profit from it, but then there are mistakes that's going to happen because this is new. I'm new to it. I tell that to myself. And then I go around in a very educated, well-informed fashion. And then I say, okay, let's say based on my understanding of reading books, I think this single family business is really good. I can manage it. There's nobody else involved. I can top to bottom. I can deal with it on my own. Now, let me go look for a real estate agent who can buy me something, maybe in a low-income neighborhood, maybe a home cost around 60 or 70 grand, maybe I put in 10,000 down and then I buy it and see how it goes. So you just do it. And then right or wrong, you tried your best to learn about it and then figure out a budget amount that you feel comfortable with, even though you lose, it's going to be, you're going to be fine. You're not going to be without food and water. And again, any business venture doesn't come without a risk. It's just about how do you mitigate that risk? You mitigate that risk with being well informed and then keeping good risk mitigation strategies. So I'm figuring out that amount which you're comfortable with and just go do it.
I think that that's great advice, that you have to be willing to lose that money and right. be okay with that. So I think that is always a great mentality to have. Not that that should stop you, you know, just being willing to take the risk. I think the other thing that you said early on as you were looking at your first one was you just asked lots of questions. So that's the other thing I would pull out of this conversation is not being afraid to ask questions. I think physicians get trained in some ways to really respect authority, whether it's a professor or a colleague or somebody else. And just from conversations with physicians, they may internalize some of those things and might be thinking them, but often questions don't get asked. And that's my impression anyhow. And I think that when it comes to investments, you have to start questioning the expert and asking those questions. What's your take on that? Am I off on that assessment, or what's your thoughts on that?
No, you are spot on. I interact with hundreds or even thousands of physicians, and just like looking at a bigger picture, there is a sense of, I am a post-doctorate person and I know a lot, but then what's missing is now they're not in a medical setting anymore. They're in a financial setting, which is a completely different school of thought. Now we are talking to people with finance degrees, people who hustled a lot in the real estate environment with the numbers, who knows the local market. So, and I think what you said is right. There is a part of, there is a component of ego that goes into the whole situation, which sometimes can come back, bite back and hurt physicians. And I keep telling people that you're in a new setting. It's not a hospital setting anymore. It's always good to ask questions. That doesn't mean, you have the mental intellect to process information. You just have to be open to receiving that information.
That's good.
And just to follow up on the previous topic that we discussed, so about taking action and how you should be willing to risk something to gain something. There is a common saying that I thought it would be a good time to bring up called analysis paralysis, right? So mm-hmm. I've seen so many people, they're thinking about it. They have their like 10,000 or 15,000 in their bank account, and they look at like, okay, 10 single family homes, and they're like, oh, this 1% rule doesn't match, or 2% rule doesn't match, or the cap rate is 7. And then they 6 months go by, and the 12 months go by, they looked at 35 properties. 2 years go by, they looked at 75 properties. So, and I think at some point you need to pick the property that makes you feel comfortable and then just go ahead and do it. And I've seen a lot of physicians kind of stuck in that little bubble where they try to get that one perfect property, and usually that never happens, because if that property looks that perfect to you, it looks equally perfect to 1,000 other investors in the same area who are willing to bid a little bit higher than you.
Yep, this is true. No, I think that's great advice. Now, in your journey so far in the real estate investing of the last 4 or 5 years, what do you think is the biggest mistake you've made?
The biggest mistake I've made is the same thing that I told a couple of minutes ago. I think I waited too long to get into the game. I think I could have easily saved at least 1.5 to 2 years if I was a bit more aggressive in the way I thought about things. Meaning, initially the way it started is I started with single family homes, and I looked at them for about 6 months. Numbers did not make sense. Then I looked at multifamily within my budget range in my location. They were kind of very competitive market, and I was like, this is not working out either. So there was evaluating those deals, assessing those deals, building those teams that can find me deals. It all took about, and then finally I evolved to slightly bigger projects where there were not as many players fighting for the same piece of property. And that one I found in the price range between 1 and 10 million. It was kind of too expensive for everyday person, and it was too little expensive for your Wall Street firms to kind of buy these kind of REIT sort of a thing. So these are usually strip malls and so on and so forth. There's still competition, but then not as much in the other segments.
And why so you formed physicianestate.com, as well as you have some other kind of sub brands where you are bringing real estate deals to various people, and looks like you've partnered with a few other doctors that are there that you know, perhaps, or it looks like a couple of them are in Kansas, one's in Missouri, so people that are kind of local to you. Tell us a bit about that. You know, why go through the trouble of doing a syndication, you know, rather than just keeping it
among them? Before I get to that point, just a bit background. So Physician Estate is just a umbrella platform which includes a whole bunch of things, and just syndications is just a part of it. Majority of it, I want it to be free resources to the community. All the things that I learn on a daily basis, that's kind of my way of giving back, saying I have a huge community of foreign trained doctors that are looking for investment properties. They have a set of questions which are pretty similar to what I had, and I immigration teams about how, like, those foreign grad physicians can invest in here, what the restrictions are with the visas. So primarily the goal of Physician Estate is to assist physician community with free resources, anything related to investing or asset protection or medical malpractice. Physicians know very little about how malpractice situation goes, meaning what insurances to get or like how things go bad or what to do to protect themselves. So it's a resource of charge. Now, a little part of what that is the syndications that I do, meaning let's say I find a property that is $2 million. I don't have the resources. So I try to find like-minded physician investors who think like me and who kind of understand the market like me, who would like to get involved in looking at the numbers and not be 100% passive investor. So I want to, like, that's kind of my goal, is to kind of work with people that I think are, they know what they're doing. And then once we, and fortunately, I luckily have at least 50 to 60 of those contacts on my phone list where I personally know them for a long time, and they're motivated to invest in real estate. They understand those numbers. So based, if I have a team of people scouting for properties, and if something comes across my table which makes sense, then we kind of set up like a group chat or some sort of thing. We analyze those numbers within our big investment group, and then whoever is interested in that project says, okay, this is something that makes sense, I want to be a part of it. And then we hire like a legal team to offer private placements to that particular team, and then we go ahead and do it.
Cool. Well, that's great. No, I think it's a sounds like a nice small community of people, lots of great educational content. You have some resources, some books, blog posts. You have even, it looks like a podcast on places that you have been, or even within your own particular platform. So if people want to learn more about you and connect and find those resources, where do you think the best place would be to do that, my friend?
Absolutely. We run like a 24/7 team to maintain the website called physicianestate.com. It has, if you're a physician who are interested in making wealth or protecting or saving your wealth, there is all sorts of content based on the category of information that you're looking for. The website would be a great place to start. We are also very active on social media. We have a really vibrant Instagram community, Facebook. The Facebook group, we try to keep it private only to investors, because we just wanted a close-knit system of physicians who are really keen on investing. So if you are like, if you think you fit the bill, just like send in an ad request, and we'll evaluate your profile and add you to the Facebook group. That's where all the discussions happen about private placements or like any projects that we're involved in. And I send a monthly newsletter about what my month's progress or updates have been, the projects I'm involved in, a look at the market, how the market's progressing overall. So sign up or subscribe for the newsletter. If you do that, you get two free ebooks. One is basic information on syndications, and the second one is asset protection strategies and how to avoid a medical malpractice lawsuit by bringing about certain changes in your practice. medical practice. So yeah, those are all the resources that are out there. Feel free to choose what you like, and yeah.
Okay. Awesome. Well, any other final thoughts? We covered a lot, talked a lot about your journey and what you've been up to and how you think about money. Any final thoughts or words of wisdom you want to leave with us?
No, yeah, absolutely. So I just think physicians it's a great community that I involve, my day-to-day involvement is with, I encourage physicians to think out of the box, venture out of their comfort zone. Yes, there is a lot of wealth in their W-2 job, but I think that wealth can be put to work to make more wealth, and there is all sorts of opportunities out there. It is just a matter of changing the mindset to look for those opportunities and learn about those opportunities. And we are always available here from Physician Estate to kind of offer any sort of free resources on the website to kind of help that cause. And that's kind of one of my main mission statements for the website.
Perfect. All right, there you are, my friends. Another great podcast. And again, you can check out everything about Harsha and the Physician Estate at physicianestate.com. And that wraps up another episode for today. Thank you again so much for joining us on the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast. Remember, my friends, remember to slash your debt, slash your taxes, and live a liberated lifestyle.